Sir? I mean Centurion. I mean Pontifex. I mean... Go. I'll go. Once Jacob had hobbled off, Octavian's face clouded. Mike, I told you not to speak of my, problem. But to answer your question, no. There still seems to be some interference with Apollo's usual gift to me. He glanced resentfully at a pile of mutilated stuffed animals heaped in the corner of the porch. I can't see the future. Perhaps that false oracle at Camp Half-Blood is working some sort of witchcraft. But as I've told you before, in strictest confidence, Apollo spoke to me clearly last year at Camp Jupiter. He personally blessed my endeavors. He promised I would be remembered as the savior of the Romans. Octavian spread his arms, revealing his harp tattoo, the symbol of his godly forefather. 7 slash marks indicated his years of service, more than any presiding officer, including Reyna. Never fear, Mike. We will crush the Greeks. We will stop Gia and her minions. Then we'll take that harpy the Greeks have been harboring, the one who memorized our Sibylline books, and we'll force her to give us the knowledge of our ancestors. Once that happens, I'm sure Apollo will restore my gift of prophecy. Camp Jupiter will be more powerful than ever. We will rule the future. Mike's scowl didn't lessen, but he raised his fist in a salute. You're the boss. Yes, I am. Octavian pulled his dagger from the table. Now, go check on those 2 dwarfs you captured. I want them properly terrified before I interrogate them again and dispatch them to Tartarus. The dream faded. Hey, wake up! Reyna's eyes fluttered open. Gleason Hedge was leaning over her, shaking her shoulder. We got trouble. His grave tone got her blood moving. What is it? She struggled to sit up. Ghosts? Monsters? Hedge scowled. Worse. Tourists. Chapter 7. Reyna. The hordes had arrived. In groups of 20 or 30, tourists swarmed through the ruins, milling around the villas, wandering the cobblestone paths, gawking at the colorful frescoes and mosaics. Reyna worried how the tourists would react to a 40-foot-tall statue of Athena in the middle of the courtyard, but the mist must have been working overtime to obscure the mortal's vision. Each time a group approached, they'd stop at the edge of the courtyard and stare in disappointment at the statue. One British tour guide announced, Ah, scaffolding. It appears this area's undergoing restoration. Pity. Let's move along. And off they went. At least the statue didn't rumble, Die, unbelievers! And zap the mortals to dust. Reyna had once dealt with the statue of the goddess Diana like that. It hadn't been her most relaxing day. She recalled what Annabeth had told her about the Athena Parthenos. Its magical aura both attracted monsters and kept them at bay. Sure enough, every so often, out of the corner of her eye, Reyna would spot glowing white spirits in Roman clothes, flitting among the ruins, frowning at the statue in consternation.
Those lemurists are everywhere, Gleason muttered. Keeping their distance for now, but come nightfall, we'd better be ready to move. Ghosts are always worse at night.
Reyna didn't need to be reminded of that. She watched as an elderly couple in matching pastel shirts and Bermuda shorts tottered through a nearby garden. She was glad they didn't come any closer. Around the camp, Coach Hedge had rigged all sorts of tripwires, snares, and oversized mousetraps that wouldn't stop any self-respecting monster, but they might very well bring down a senior citizen. Despite the warm morning, Reyna shivered from her dreams. She couldn't decide which was more terrifying, the impending destruction of New Rome
or the way Octavian was poisoning the Legion from the inside.
Your quest is a fool's errand.
Camp Jupiter needed her. The 12th Legion needed her. Yet Reyna was halfway across the world, watching a satyr cook Eggo blueberry waffles on a stick over an open fire. She wanted to talk about her nightmares, but she decided to wait until Nico woke up. She wasn't sure she'd have the courage to describe them twice. Nico kept snoring. Reyna had discovered that once he fell asleep, it took a lot to wake him up. The coach could do a goat hoof tap dance around Nico's head, and the son of Hades wouldn't even budge.
Here.
Hedge offered her a plate of flame-broiled Eggos with fresh-sliced kiwi and pineapple. It all looked surprisingly good.
Where are you getting these supplies?
Reyna marveled.
Hey, I'm a satyr. We're very efficient packers.
He took a bite of waffle.
We also know how to live off the land.
As Reyna ate, Coach Hedge took out a notepad and started to write. When he was finished, he folded the paper into an airplane and tossed it into the air. A breeze carried it away.
A letter to your wife?
Reyna guessed. Under the rim of his baseball cap, Hedge's eyes were bloodshot.
Melly's a cloud nymph. Air spirits send stuff by paper airplane all the time. Hopefully her cousins will keep the letter going across the ocean until it finds her. It's not as fast as an iris message, but, well, I want our kid to have some record of me, in case, you know.
We'll get you home, Reyna promised. You will see your kid.
Hedge clenched his jaw and said nothing. Reyna was pretty good at getting people to talk. She considered it essential to know her comrades in arms, but she'd had a tough time convincing Hedge to open up about his wife, Melly, who was close to giving birth back at Camp Half-Blood. Reyna had trouble imagining the coach as a father, but she understood what it was like to grow up without parents. She wasn't going to let that happen to Coach Hedge's child.
Yeah, well...
The satyr bit off another piece of Eggo, including the stick he'd toasted it on.
I just wish we could move faster.
He chin-pointed to Nico.
I don't see how this kid is going to last one more jump. How many more will it take us to get home?
Reyna shared his concern. In only 11 days, the Giants planned to awaken Gia. Octavian planned to attack Camp Half-Blood on the same day. That couldn't be a coincidence. Perhaps Gia was whispering in Octavian's ear, influencing his decision subconsciously. Or worse, Octavian was actively in league with the Earth Goddess. Reyna didn't want to believe that even Octavian would knowingly betray the Legion, but after what she'd seen in her dreams, she couldn't be sure. She finished her meal as a group of Chinese tourists shuffled past the courtyard. Reyna had been awake for less than an hour, and already she was restless to get moving.
Thanks for breakfast, Coach.
She got to her feet and stretched.
If you'll excuse me, where there are tourists, there are bathrooms. I need to use the little praetor's room.
Go ahead.
The coach jangled the whistle that hung around his neck.
If anything happens, I'll blow.
Reyna left Aram and Argentum on guard duty and strolled through the crowds of mortals until she found a visitor center with restrooms. She did her best to clean up, but she found it ironic that she was in an actual Roman city and couldn't enjoy a nice hot Roman bath. She had to settle for paper towels, a broken soap dispenser, and an asthmatic hand dryer. And the toilets? The less said about those, the better. As she was walking back, she passed a small museum with a window display. Behind the glass lay a row of plaster figures, all frozen in the throes of death. A young girl was curled in a fetal position. A woman lay twisted in agony, her mouth open to scream, her arms thrown overhead. A man knelt with his head bowed, as if accepting the inevitable. Reyna stared with a mixture of horror and revulsion. She'd read about such figures, but she'd never seen them in person. After the eruption of Vesuvius, volcanic ash had buried the city and hardened to rock around dying Pompeians. Their bodies had disintegrated, leaving behind human-shaped pockets of air. Early archaeologists had poured plaster into the holes and made these casts, creepy replicas of ancient Romans. Reyna found it disturbing, wrong, that these people's dying moments were on display like clothes in a shop window. Yet she couldn't look away. All her life she'd dreamed about coming to Italy. She had assumed it would never happen. The ancient lands were forbidden to modern demigods. The area was simply too dangerous. Nevertheless, she wanted to follow in the footsteps of Aeneas, son of Aphrodite, the first demigod to settle here after the Trojan War. She wanted to see the original Tiber River, where Lupa, the wolf goddess, saved Romulus and Remus. But Pompeii? Reyna had never wanted to come here. The site of Rome's most infamous disaster, an entire city swallowed by the earth. After Reyna's nightmares, that hit a little too close to home. So far in the ancient lands, she'd only seen one place on her wish list, Diocletian's palace in Split, and even that visit had hardly gone the way she'd imagined. Reyna used to dream about going there with Jason to admire their favorite emperor's home. She pictured romantic walks with him through the old city, sunset picnics on the parapets. Instead, Reyna had arrived in Croatia not with him, but with a dozen angry wind spirits on her tail. She'd fought her way through ghosts in the palace. On her way out, griffins had attacked, mortally wounding her Pegasus. The closest she'd gotten to Jason was finding a note he'd left for her under a bust of Diocletian in the basement. She would only have painful memories of that place.
"Don't be bitter," she chided herself. "Aeneas suffered too. So did Romulus, Diocletian, and all the rest. Romans don't complain about hardship."
Staring at the plaster death figures in the museum window, she wondered what they had been thinking as they curled up to die in the ashes. Probably not, "Well, we're Romans. We shouldn't complain." A gust of wind blew through the ruins, making a hollow moan. Sunlight flashed against the window, momentarily blinding her. With a start, Reyna looked up. The sun was directly overhead. How could it be noon already? She'd left the House of the Faun just after breakfast. She'd only been standing here a few minutes, hadn't she? She tore herself from the museum display and hurried off, trying to shake the feeling that the dead Pompeians were whispering behind her back. The rest of the afternoon was unnervingly quiet. Reyna kept watch while Coach Hedge slept, but there was nothing much to guard against. Tourists came and went. Random harpies and wind spirits flew by overhead. Reyna's dogs would snarl in warning, but the monsters didn't stop to fight. Ghosts skulked around the edges of the courtyard, apparently intimidated by the Athena Parthenos. Reyna couldn't blame them. The longer the statue stood in Pompeii, the more anger it seemed to radiate, making Reyna's skin itchy and her nerves raw. Finally, just after sunset, Nico woke. He wolfed down an avocado and cheese sandwich, the first time he'd shown a decent appetite since leaving the House of Hades. Reyna hated to ruin his dinner, but they didn't have much time. As the daylight faded, the ghosts started moving closer and in greater numbers. She told him about her dreams, the earth swallowing Camp Jupiter, Octavian closing in on Camp Half-Blood, and the hunter with the glowing eyes who had shot Reyna in the gut. Nico stared at his empty plate.
"This hunter, a giant maybe?"
Coach Hedge grunted.
"I'd rather not find out. I say we keep moving."
Nico's mouth twitched.
"You are suggesting we avoid a fight?"
Listen, Cupcake, I like a smackdown as much as the next guy, but we've got enough monsters to worry about without some bounty hunter giant tracking us across the world. I don't like the sound of those huge arrows.
For once, Reyna said, I agree with Hedge. Nico unfolded his aviator jacket. He put his finger through an arrow hole in the sleeve.
I could ask for advice.
Nico sounded reluctant.
Thalia Grace.
Jason's sister, Reyna said. She'd never met Thalia. In fact, she'd only recently learned Jason had a sister. According to Jason, she was a Greek demigod, a daughter of Zeus, who led a group of Artemis's followers. The whole idea made Reyna's head spin. Nico nodded.
The hunters of Artemis are, well, hunters. If anybody knew about this giant hunter guy, Thalia would. I could try sending her an Iris message.
You don't sound very excited about the idea, Reyna noticed. Are you two on bad terms?
We're fine.
A few feet away, Aram snarled quietly, which meant Nico was lying. Reyna decided not to press. I should also try to contact my sister, Hilla, she said. Camp Jupiter is lightly defended. If Gia attacks there, perhaps the Amazons could help.
Coach Hedge scowled. No offense, but, what's an army of Amazons going to do against a wave of dirt?
Reyna fought down a sense of dread. She suspected Hedge was right. Against what she'd seen in her dreams, the only defense would be to prevent the giants from waking Gia. For that, she had to put her trust in the crew of the Argo II. The daylight was almost gone. Around the courtyard, ghosts were forming a mob. Hundreds of glowing Romans carrying spectral clubs or stones.
We can talk more after the next jump, Reyna decided. Right now, we need to get out of here.
Yeah.
Nico stood.
I think we can reach Spain this time if we're lucky. Just let me...
The mob of ghosts vanished, like a mass of birthday candles blown out in a single breath. Reyna's hand went to her dagger.
Where do they go?
Nico's eyes flitted across the ruins. His expression was not reassuring.
I'm not sure, but I don't think it's a good sign. Keep a lookout. I'll get harnessed up. Should only take a few seconds.
Gleason Hedge rose to his hooves.
A few seconds you do not have.
Reyna's stomach curled into a tiny ball. Hedge spoke with a woman's voice, the same one Reyna had heard in her nightmare. She drew her knife. Hedge turned toward her, his face expressionless. His eyes were solid black.
Be glad, Reyna Ramirez Arellano. You will die as a Roman. You will join the ghosts of Pompeii.
The ground rumbled. All around the courtyard, spirals of ash swirled into the air. They solidified into crude human figures, earthen shells like the ones in the museum. They stared at Reyna, their eyes ragged holes in faces of rock.
The earth will swallow you, Hedge said in the voice of Gia, just as it swallowed them.
Chapter 8. Reyna.
There are too many of them.
Reyna wondered bitterly how many times she'd said that in her demigod career. She should have a button made and wear it around to save time. When she died, the words would probably be written on her tombstone. There were too many of them. Her greyhound stood on either side of her, growling at the earthen shells. Reyna counted at least 20. Closing in from every direction.
Coach Hedge continued to speak in a very womanly voice.
The dead always outnumber the living. These spirits have waited centuries, unable to express their anger. Now I have given them bodies of earth.
One earthen ghost stepped forward. It moved slowly, but its footfall was so heavy it cracked the ancient tiles.
Nico? Reyna called.
I can't control them,
he said, frantically untangling his harness.
Something about the rock shells, I guess. I need a couple of seconds to concentrate on making the shadow jump. Otherwise, I might teleport us into another volcano.
Reyna cursed under her breath. There was no way she could fight off so many by herself while Nico prepared their escape, especially with Coach Hedge out of commission.
Use the scepter, she said. Get me some zombies.
It will not help,
Coach Hedge intoned.
Stand aside, Breeder. Let the ghosts of Pompeii destroy this Greek statue. A true Roman would not resist.
The earthen ghosts shuffled forward. Through their mouth holes, they made hollow whistling noises, like someone blowing across empty soda bottles. One stepped on the coach's dagger tennis racket trap and smashed it to pieces. From his belt, Nico pulled the scepter of Diocletian.
Reyna, if I summon more dead Romans, who's to say they won't join this mob?
I say, I am a praetor. Get me some legionnaires, and I'll control them.
You shall perish, said the coach. You shall never...
Reyna smacked him on the head with the pommel of her knife. The satyr crumpled.
Sorry, coach, she muttered. That was getting tiresome. Nico, zombies! Then concentrate on getting us out of here.
Nico raised his scepter and the ground trembled. The earthen ghosts chose that moment to charge. Aram leaped at the nearest one and literally bit the creature's head off with his metal fangs. The rock shell toppled backward and shattered. Argentum was not so lucky. He sprang at another ghost, which swung its heavy arm and bashed the greyhound in his face. Argentum went flying. He staggered to his feet. His head was twisted 45 degrees to the right. One of his ruby eyes was missing. Anger hammered in Reyna's chest like a hot spike. She'd already lost her Pegasus. She was not going to lose her dogs, too. She slashed her knife through the ghost's chest, then drew her gladius. Strictly speaking, fighting with two blades wasn't very Roman, but Reyna had spent time with pirates. She'd picked up more than a few tricks. The earthen shells crumbled easily, but they hit like sledgehammers. Reyna didn't understand how, but she knew she couldn't afford to take even one blow. Unlike Argentum, she wouldn't survive getting her head knocked sideways.
Nico!
She ducked between two earthen ghosts, allowing them to smash each other's heads in.
Any time now!
The ground split open down the center of the courtyard. Dozens of skeletal soldiers clawed their way to the surface. Their shields looked like giant corroded pennies. Their blades were more rust than metal, but Reyna had never been so relieved to see reinforcements.
Legion! She shouted. Ad Occhium!
The zombies responded, pushing through the earthen ghosts to form a battle line. Some fell, crushed by stone fists. Others managed to close ranks and raise their shields. Behind her, Nico cursed. Reyna risked a backward glance. The scepter of Diocletian was smoking in Nico's hands.
It's fighting me, he yelled. I don't think it likes summoning Romans to fight other Romans.
Reyna knew that ancient Romans had spent at least half their time fighting each other, but she decided not to bring that up.
Just secure Coach Hedge. Get ready to shadow travel. I'll buy you some...
Nico yelped. The scepter of Diocletian exploded into pieces. Nico didn't look hurt, but he stared at Reyna in shock.
I don't know what happened. You've got a few minutes, tops, before your zombies disappear.
Legion, Reyna shouted. Orbem formate, gladium signe.
The zombies circled the Athena Parthenos, their swords ready for close quarters fighting. Argentum dragged the unconscious Coach Hedge over to Nico, who was furiously strapping himself into the harness. Aram stood guard, lunging at any Earth ghost who broke through the line. Reyna fought shoulder to shoulder with the dead legionnaires, sending her strength into their ranks. She knew it wouldn't be enough. The earthen ghosts fell easily, but more kept rising from the ground in swirls of ash. Each time their stone fists connected, another zombie went down. Meanwhile, the Athena Parthenos towered over the battle, regal, haughty, and unconcerned. A little help would be nice, Reyna thought. Maybe a destructo ray? Or some good old-fashioned smiting? The statue did nothing except radiate hatred, which seemed directed equally at Reyna and the attacking ghosts.
You want to lug me to Long Island? The statue seemed to say. Good luck with that, Roman scum.
Reyna's destiny. To die defending a passive-aggressive goddess. She kept fighting, extending more of her will into the undead troops. In return, they bombarded her with their despair and resentment.
You fight for nothing, the zombie legionnaires whispered in her mind. The Empire is gone.
For Rome,
Reyna cried hoarsely. She slashed her gladius through one earthen ghost and stabbed her dagger in another's chest.
12th Legion Fulminata!
All around her, zombies fell. Some were crushed in battle. Others disintegrated on their own as the residual power of Diocletian's scepter finally failed. The earthen ghosts closed in, a sea of misshapen faces with hollow eyes.
Reyna, now! Nico yelled. We're leaving!
She glanced back. Nico had harnessed himself to the Athena Parthenos. He held the unconscious Gleason Hedge in his arms like a damsel in distress. Aram and Argentum had disappeared, perhaps too badly damaged to continue fighting. Reyna stumbled. A rock first gave her a glancing blow to the ribcage, and her side erupted in pain. Her head swam. She tried to breathe, but it was like inhaling knives.
Reyna!
Nico shouted again. The Athena Parthenos flickered, about to disappear. An earthen ghost swung at Reyna's head. She managed to dodge, but the pain in her ribs almost made her black out.
Give up, said the voices in her head. The legacy of Rome is dead and buried, just like Pompeii.
No,
she murmured to herself.
Not while I'm still alive.
Nico stretched out his hand as he slipped into the shadows. With the last of her strength, Reyna leaped toward him. Chapter 9. Leo. Leo didn't want to come out of the wall. He had 3 more braces to attach, and nobody else was skinny enough to fit in the crawlspace. One of the many advantages of being scrawny. Wedged between the layers of the hull with the plumbing and wiring, Leo could be alone with his thoughts. When he got frustrated, which happened about every 5 seconds, he could hit stuff with his mallet, and the other crew members would figure he was working, not throwing a tantrum. One problem with his sanctuary? He only fit up to his waist. His butt and legs were still on view to the general public, which made it hard for him to hide.
Leo!
Piper's voice came from somewhere behind him.
We need you!
The celestial bronze O-ring slipped out of Leo's pliers and slid into the depths of the crawlspace. Leo sighed.
Talk to the pants, Piper, 'cause the hands are busy.
I am not talking to the pants. Meeting in the mess hall. We're almost to Olympia.
Yeah, fine. I'll be there in a sec.
What are you doing anyway? You've been poking around inside the hull for days.
Leo swept his flashlight across the celestial bronze plates and pistons he'd been installing slowly but surely.
Routine maintenance.
Silence. Piper was a little too good at knowing when he was lying. Leo.
Hey, while you're out there, do me a favor. I got this itch right below my...
Fine, I'm leaving. Leo allowed himself a couple more minutes to fasten the brace. His work wasn't done, not by a long shot, but he was making progress. Of course, he'd laid the groundwork for his secret project when he first built the Argo II, but he hadn't told anyone about it. He had barely been honest with himself about what he was doing.
Nothing lasts forever, his dad once told him. Not even the best machines.
Yeah, okay, maybe that was true. But Hephaestus had also said,
everything can be reused.
Leo intended to test that theory. It was a dangerous risk. If he failed, it would crush him. Not just emotionally. It would physically crush him. The thought made him claustrophobic. He wriggled out of the crawl space and went back into his cabin. Well, technically it was his cabin, but he didn't sleep there. The mattress was littered with wires, nails, and the guts of several disassembled bronze machines. His three massive rolling tool cabinets, Chico, Harpo, and Groucho, took up most of the room. Dozens of power tools hung on the walls. The work table was piled with photocopied blueprints from On Spheres, the forgotten Archimedes text Leo had liberated from an underground workshop in Rome. Even if he wanted to sleep in his cabin, it would have been too cramped and dangerous. He preferred to bed down in the engine room, where the constant hum of machinery helped him fall asleep. Besides, ever since his time on the island of Ogygia, he had become fond of camping out. A bedroll on the floor was all he needed. His cabin was only for storage, and for working on his most difficult projects. He pulled his keys from his tool belt. He didn't really have time, but he unlocked Groucho's middle drawer and stared at the two precious objects inside. A bronze astrolabe he'd picked up in Bologna, and a fist-sized chunk of crystal from Ogygia. Leo hadn't figured out how to put the two things together yet, and it was driving him crazy. He'd been hoping to get some answers when they visited Ithaca. After all, it was the home of Odysseus, the dude who had constructed the astrolabe. But judging from what Jason had said, those ruins hadn't held any answers for him. Just a bunch of ill-tempered ghouls and ghosts. Anyway, Odysseus never got the astrolabe to work. He hadn't had a crystal to use as a homing beacon. Leo did. He would have to succeed where the cleverest demigod of all time had failed. Just Leo's luck. A super-hot immortal girl was waiting for him on Ogygia, but he couldn't figure out how to wire a stupid chunk of rock into the 3,000-year-old navigation device. Some problems even duct tape couldn't solve. Leo closed the drawer and locked it. His eyes drifted to the bulletin board above his work table, where two pictures hung side by side. The first was the old crayon drawing he'd made when he was 7 years old, a diagram of a flying ship he'd seen in his dreams. The second was a charcoal sketch Hazel had recently made for him. Hazel Levesque. That girl was something. As soon as Leo rejoined the crew in Malta, she'd known right away that Leo was hurting inside. The first chance she got, after all that mess in the House of Hades, she'd marched into Leo's cabin and said, "Spill." Hazel was a good listener. Leo told her the whole story. Later that evening, Hazel came back with her sketch pad and her charcoal pencils. "Describe her," she insisted. "Every detail." It felt a little weird, helping Hazel make a portrait of Calypso, as if he were talking to a police artist. "Yes, officer, that's the girl who stole my heart." Sounded like a freaking country song. But describing Calypso had been easy. Leo couldn't close his eyes without seeing her. Now her likeness gazed back at him from the bulletin board. Her almond-shaped eyes, her pouty lips, her long, straight hair swept over one shoulder of her sleeveless dress. He could almost smell her cinnamon fragrance. Her knit brow and the downward turn of her mouth seemed to say, "Leo Valdez, you are so full of it." Dang, he loved that woman. Leo had pinned her portrait next to the drawing of the Argo II to remind himself that sometimes visions do come true. As a little kid, he dreamed about a flying ship. Eventually, he built it. Now he would build a way to get back to Calypso. The hum of the ship's engines changed to a lower pitch. Over the cabin loudspeaker, Festus's voice creaked and squeaked. "Yeah, thanks, buddy," Leo said. "On my way." The ship was descending, which meant Leo's projects would have to wait. "Sit tight, sunshine," he told Calypso's picture. "I'll get back to you, just like I promised." Leo could imagine her response. "I am not waiting for you, Leo Valdez. I am not in love with you, and I certainly don't believe your foolish promises." The thought made him smile. He slipped his keys back into his tool belt and headed for the mess hall. The other six demigods were eating breakfast. Once upon a time, Leo would have worried about all of them being together below decks with nobody at the helm. But ever since Piper had permanently woken up Festus with her charm speak, a feat Leo still did not understand, the dragon figurehead had been more than capable of running the Argo II by himself. Festus could navigate, check the radar, make a blueberry smoothie, and spew white-hot jets of fire at invaders, simultaneously, without even blowing a circuit. Besides, they had Buford the Wonder Table as backup. After Coach Hedge left on his shadow travel expedition, Leo had decided that his three-legged table could do just as good a job as their adult chaperone. He had laminated Buford's tabletop with a magic scroll that projected a pint-sized holographic simulation of Coach Hedge. Minnie Hedge would stomp around on Buford's top, randomly saying things like, "Cut that out! I'm gonna kill you!" and the ever-popular, "Put some clothes on!" Today, Buford was manning the helm. If Festus's flames didn't scare away the monsters, Buford's holographic hedge definitely would. Leo stood in the doorway of the mess hall, taking in the scene around the dining table. It wasn't often he got to see all his friends together. Percy was eating a huge stack of blue pancakes. What was his deal with blue food? While Annabeth chided him for pouring on too much syrup. "You're drowning them," she complained.
"Hey, I'm a Poseidon kid," he said. "I can't drown, and neither can my pancakes."
To their left, Frank and Hazel used their cereal bowls to flatten out a map of Greece. They looked over it, their heads close together. Every once in a while, Frank's hand would cover Hazel's, just sweet and natural, like they were an old married couple. And Hazel didn't even look flustered, which was real progress for a girl from the 1940s. Until recently, if somebody said, "Gosh darn," she would nearly faint. At the head of the table, Jason sat uncomfortably with his T-shirt rolled up to his rib cage as Nurse Piper changed his bandages.
"Hold still," she said. "I know it hurts."
"It's just cold," he said.
Leo could hear the pain in his voice. That stupid gladius blade had pierced him all the way through. The entrance wound on his back was an ugly shade of purple, and it steamed. Probably not a good sign. Piper tried to stay positive, but privately she had told Leo how worried she was. Ambrosia, nectar, and mortal medicine could only help so much. A deep cut from celestial bronze or imperial gold could literally dissolve a demigod's essence from the inside out. Jason might get better. He claimed he felt better, but Piper wasn't so sure. Too bad Jason wasn't a metal automaton. At least then, Leo would have some idea of how to help his best friend. But with humans, Leo felt helpless. They broke way too easily. He loved his friends. He'd do anything for them. But as he looked at the six of them, three couples, all focused on each other, he thought about the warning from Nemesis, the revenge goddess.
You will not find a place among your brethren. You will always be the seventh wheel.
He was starting to think Nemesis was right. Assuming Leo lived long enough, assuming his crazy secret plan worked, his destiny was with somebody else, on an island that no man ever found twice. But for now, the best he could do was to follow his old rule. Keep moving. Don't get bogged down. Don't think about the bad stuff. Smile and joke even when you don't feel like it. Especially when you don't feel like it.
What's up, guys?
He strolled into the mess hall.
Aw, yes, to brownies.
He grabbed the last one, from a special sea salt recipe they'd picked up from Aphros, the fish centaur at the bottom of the Atlantic. The intercom crackled. Buford's mini hedge yelled over the speakers,
"Put some clothes on!"
Everyone jumped. Hazel ended up 5 feet away from Frank. Percy spilled syrup in his orange juice. Jason awkwardly wriggled back into his t-shirt, and Frank turned into a bulldog. Piper glared at Leo.
I thought you were getting rid of that stupid hologram.
Hey, Buford's just saying good morning. He loves his hologram. Besides, we all miss the coach, and Frank makes a cute bulldog.
Frank morphed back into a burly, grumpy Chinese-Canadian dude.
Just sit down, Leo. We've got stuff to talk about.
Leo squeezed in between Jason and Hazel. He figured they were the least likely to smack him if he made bad jokes. He took a bite of his brownie and grabbed a pack of Italian junk food. Fonzie's, to round out his balanced breakfast. He'd become kind of addicted to the things since buying some in Bologna. They were cheesy and corny, two of his favorite qualities.
So, Jason winced as he leaned forward. We're going to stay airborne and drop anchor as close as we can to Olympia. It's farther inland than I'd like, about 5 miles, but we don't have much choice. According to Juno, we have to find the goddess of victory and, subdue her.
Uncomfortable silence around the table. With the new drapes covering the holographic walls, the mess hall was darker and gloomier than it should have been. But that couldn't be helped. Ever since the Kirkopi's dwarf twins had short-circuited the walls, the real-time video feed from Camp Half-Blood often fuzzed out, changing into playback of extreme dwarf close-ups, red whiskers, nostrils, and bad dental work. It wasn't helpful when you were trying to eat or have a serious conversation about the fate of the world. Percy sipped his syrup-flavored orange juice. He seemed to find it okay.
I'm cool with fighting the occasional goddess, but isn't Nike one of the good ones? I mean, personally, I like victory. I can't get enough of it.
Annabeth drummed her fingers on the table.
It does seem strange. I understand why Nike would be in Olympia, home of the Olympics and all that. The contestants sacrificed to her. Greeks and Romans worshipped her there for like 1,200 years, right?
Almost to the end of the Roman Empire,
Frank agreed.
Romans called her Victoria, but same difference. Everybody loved her. Who doesn't like to win? Not sure why we would have to subdue her.
Jason frowned. A wisp of steam curled from the wound under his shirt.
All I know, the ghoul Antinous said, victory runs rampant in Olympia. Juno warned us that we could never heal the rift between the Greeks and Romans unless we defeated victory.
How do we defeat victory? Piper wondered. Sounds like one of those impossible riddles.
Like making stones fly, Leo said. Or eating only one Fonzie.
He popped a handful into his mouth. Hazel wrinkled her nose.
That stuff is going to kill you.
You kidding? So many preservatives in these things, I'll live forever.
But, hey, about this victory goddess being popular and great, don't you guys remember what her kids are like at Camp Half-Blood?
Hazel and Frank had never been to Camp Half-Blood, but the others nodded gravely.
He's got a point, Percy said. Those kids in Cabin 17, they're super competitive. When it comes to capture the flag, they're almost worse than the Ares kids.
No offense, Frank.
Frank shrugged.
You're saying Nike has a dark side?
Her kids sure do, Annabeth said. They never turn down a challenge. They have to be number one at everything. If their mom is that intense...
Whoa. Piper put her hands on the table like the ship was rocking.
Guys, all the gods are split between their Greek and Roman aspects, right? If Nike's that way, and she's the goddess of victory...
She'd be really conflicted, Annabeth said. She'd want one side or the other to win so she could declare a victor. She'd literally be fighting with herself.
Hazel nudged her cereal bowl across the map of Greece.
But we don't want one side or the other to win. We've got to get the Greeks and Romans on the same team.
Maybe that's the problem, Jason said. If the goddess of victory is running rampant, torn between Greek and Roman, she might make it impossible to bring the two camps together.
How?
Leo asked.
Start a flame war on Twitter?
Percy stabbed at his pancakes.
Maybe she's like Ares. That guy can spark a fight by just walking into a crowded room. If Nike radiates competitive vibes or something, she could aggravate the whole Greek-Roman rivalry big time.
Frank pointed at Percy.
You remember that old sea god in Atlanta, Phorcys? He said that Gia's plans always have lots of layers. This could be part of the giant strategy. Keep the two camps divided, keep the gods divided. If that's the case, we can't let Nike play us against each other. We should send a landing party of four. Two Greeks, two Romans. The balance might help keep her balanced.
Listening to Jong, Leo had one of those double-take moments.
He couldn't believe how much the guy had changed in the last few weeks.
Frank wasn't just taller and buffer. He was more confident now, more willing to take charge. Maybe that was because his magic firewood lifeline was safely stashed away in a flame-proof pouch. Or maybe it was because he'd commanded a zombie legion and gotten promoted to praetor. Whatever the case, Leo had trouble seeing him as the same klutzy dude who'd once iguanaed his way out of Chinese handcuffs.
I think Frank is right, Annabeth said. A party of four. We'll have to be careful who goes. We don't want to do anything that might make the goddess, more unstable.
I'll go, Piper said. I can try charm speaking.
Worry lines deepened around Annabeth's eyes.
Not this time, Piper. Nike is all about competition. Aphrodite, well, she is too in her own way. I think Nike might see you as a threat.
Once, Leo might have made a joke about that. Piper a threat? The girl was like a sister to him, but if he needed help beating up a gang of thugs or subduing a victory goddess, Piper was not the first person he'd turn to. Recently, though, well, Piper may not have changed as obviously as Frank, but she had changed. She had stabbed Keone, the snow goddess, in the chest. She had defeated the Boreads. She'd slashed up a flock of wild harpies single-handedly. As for her charm speak, she'd gotten so powerful it made Leo nervous. If she told him to eat his vegetables, he might actually do it. Annabeth's words didn't seem to upset her. Piper just nodded and scanned the group.
Who should go, then?
Jason and Percy shouldn't go together, Annabeth said. Jupiter and Poseidon? Bad combination. Nike could start you two fighting easily.
Percy gave her a sideways smile.
Yeah,
We can't have another incident like in Kansas. I might kill my bro Jason.
Or I might kill my bro Percy, Jason said amiably.
Which proves my point, Annabeth said. We also shouldn't send Frank and me together. Mars and Athena, that would be just as bad.
Okay, Leo broke in. So Percy and me for the Greeks, Frank and Hazel for the Romans. Is that the ultimate non-competitive dream team or what?
Annabeth and Frank exchanged war-godly looks.
It could work, Frank decided. I mean, no combination is going to be perfect, but Poseidon, Hephaestus, Pluto, Mars, I don't see any huge antagonism there.
Hazel traced her finger along the map of Greece.
I still wish we could have gone through the Gulf of Corinth. I was hoping we could visit Delphi, maybe get some advice. Plus, it's such a long way around the Peloponnese.
Yeah.
Leo's heart sank when he looked at how much coastline they still had to navigate.
It's July 22nd already. Counting today, only 10 days until...
I know, Jason said. But Juno was clear. The shorter way would have been suicide.
And as for Delphi,
Piper leaned toward the map. The blue harpy feather in her hair swung like a pendulum.
What's going on there? If Apollo doesn't have his oracle anymore...
Percy grunted. Probably something to do with that creep Octavian. Maybe he was so bad at telling the future, he broke Apollo's powers.
Jason managed a smile, though his eyes were cloudy from pain.
Hopefully we can find Apollo and Artemis. Then you can ask him yourself. Juno said the twins might be willing to help us.
A lot of unanswered questions, Frank muttered. A lot of miles to cover before we get to Athens.
First things first, Annabeth said. You guys have to find Nike and figure out how to subdue her. Whatever Juno meant by that. I still don't understand how you defeat a goddess who controls victory. Seems impossible.
Leo started to grin. He couldn't help it. Sure, they only had 10 days to stop the giants from waking Gia. Sure, he could die before dinner time. But he loved being told that something was impossible. It was like someone handing him a lemon meringue pie and telling him not to throw it. He just couldn't resist the challenge.
We'll see about that.
He rose to his feet.
Let me get my collection of grenades, and I'll meet you guys on deck.
Chapter 10. Leo.
Smart call back there, Percy said, choosing the air conditioning.
He and Leo had just searched the museum. Now they were sitting on a bridge that spanned the Cladios River, their feet dangling over the water as they waited for Frank and Hazel to finish scouting the ruins. To their left, the Olympic Valley shimmered in the afternoon heat. To their right, the visitor's lot was crammed with tour buses. Good thing the Argo II was moored 100 feet in the air, because they never would have found parking. Leo skipped a stone across the river. He wished Hazel and Frank would get back. He felt awkward hanging out with Percy. For one thing, he wasn't sure what kind of small talk to make with a guy who'd recently come back from Tartarus.
Catch that last episode of Doctor Who? Oh, right. You were trudging through the pit of eternal damnation.
Percy had been intimidating enough before, summoning hurricanes, dueling pirates, killing giants in the Colosseum. Now, well, after what happened in Tartarus, it seemed like Percy had graduated to a totally different level of butt-kickery. Leo had trouble even thinking of him as part of the same camp. The two of them had never been at Camp Half-Blood at the same time. Percy's leather necklace had 4 beads for 4 completed summers. Leo's leather necklace had exactly none. The only thing they had in common was Calypso, and every time Leo thought about that, he wanted to punch Percy in the face. Leo kept thinking he should bring it up, just to clear the air. But the timing never seemed right, and as the days went by, the subject got harder and harder to broach.
What?
Percy asked. Leo stirred.
What?
You were staring at me like... angry.
Was I?
Leo tried to muster a joke, or at least a smile, but he couldn't.
Sorry.
Percy gazed at the river.
I suppose we need to talk.
He opened his hand, and the stone Leo had skipped flew out of the stream, right into Percy's palm.
Oh, Leo thought, we're showing off now?
He considered shooting a column of fire at the nearest tour bus and blowing up the gas tank, but he decided that might be a tad dramatic.
Maybe we should talk, but not...
Guys!
Frank stood up at the far end of the parking lot, waving at them to come over. Next to him, Hazel sat astride her horse, Orion, who had appeared unannounced as soon as they'd landed. Saved by the Jong, Leo thought. He and Percy jogged over to meet their friends.
This place is huge, Frank reported. The ruins stretch from the river to the base of that mountain over there, about half a kilometer.
How far is that in regular measurements?
Percy asked. Frank rolled his eyes.
That is a regular measurement in Canada and the rest of the world. Only you Americans...
About 5 or 6 football fields,
Hazel interceded, feeding Orion a big chunk of gold. Percy spread his hands.
That's all you needed to say.
Anyway, Frank continued, from overhead, I didn't see anything suspicious.
Neither did I, Hazel said.
Orion took me on a complete loop around the perimeter. A lot of tourists, but no crazy goddess. The big stallion nickered and tossed his head, his neck muscles rippling under his butterscotch coat.
Man, your horse can cuss.
Percy shook his head.
He doesn't think much of Olympia.
For once, Leo agreed with the horse. He didn't like the idea of tromping through fields full of ruins under a blazing sun, shoving his way through hordes of sweaty tourists while searching for a split-personality victory goddess. Besides, Frank had already flown over the whole valley as an eagle. If his sharp eyes hadn't seen anything, maybe there was nothing to see. On the other hand, Leo's tool belt pockets were full of dangerous toys. He would hate to go home without blowing anything up.
"So we blunder around together," he said. And let trouble find us. It's always worked before.
They poked around for a while, avoiding tour groups and ducking from one patch of shade to the next. Not for the first time, Leo was struck by how similar Greece was to his home state of Texas. The low hills, the scrubby trees, the drone of cicadas, and the oppressive summer heat. Switch out the ancient columns and ruined temples for cows and barbed wire, and Leo would have felt right at home. Frank found a tourist pamphlet. Seriously, that dude would read the ingredients on a soup can. And gave them a running commentary on what was what.
This is the Propylon.
He waved toward a stone path lined with crumbling columns.
One of the main gates into the Olympic Valley.
Rubble, said Leo.
And over there...
Frank pointed to a square foundation that looked like the patio for a Mexican restaurant.
Is the Temple of Hera, one of the oldest structures here.
More rubble, Leo said.
And that round bandstand-looking thing, that's the Philippion, dedicated to Philip of Macedonia.
Even more rubble. First-rate rubble.
Hazel, who was still riding Orion, kicked Leo in the arm.
Doesn't anything impress you?
Leo glanced up. Her curly gold-brown hair and golden eyes matched her helmet and sword so well she might have been engineered from Imperial gold. Leo doubted Hazel would consider that a compliment, but as far as humans went, Hazel was first-rate craftsmanship. Leo remembered their trip together through the House of Hades. Hazel had led him through that creepy maze of illusions. She'd made the sorceress pacify